Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this DeLimeArc technical net. For more than 43 years, this net has been going strong, where people would sit in front of their radios and chat with each other, inform each other, learn from each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you all once again for joining me this particular Sunday night at 8 p.m. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. If you want to contact me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, TechNet puzzles, or if you had some expertise in a technological field that's in the news, or if you just want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at space and NASA-related stories. That's what the email is for, and my email is mailbag@ac2gs.com. You could also email Paul. He's available. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. As I've often mentioned, I collect a cut-and-paste bunch of interesting articles. I put it on a link page, and I leave it there for a long, long time. So if you want to gain access to the link page, you just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that will be available for years to come, probably. At your leisure, if you're kind of bored and don't have anything better to do, you can look around, and hopefully there will be some interesting articles for you, because I found them interesting. In addition, we maintain a chat room. Sometimes it's very, very quiet. Sometimes it's very, very loud and noisy. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And we offer an audio stream on the Internet of the technical net. We leave it live the rest of the week, so you can listen in to Glen Oaks repeater if you don't have a radio handy. And you get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as I would always like to remind people, we have MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the DeLimeArc technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So if you're curious, and I'm telling you, there's a lot of wisdom in those recordings. Dick K2RIW is on most of them, and a lot of other very, very smart hams who unfortunately have since become silent keys. So avail yourself of that. Anyway, I will return with a short first segment of some interesting things that I've seen in the news of a technical nature, and then we'll go on from there. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, this has been a particularly noisy week for artificial intelligence. A lot of guys promoting all kinds of semi-stupid things. They talk about not only general intelligence being expected sometime this year, which I tend to doubt, but super intelligence coming right after it. And they promise everything from, living forever, doing away with cancer, and some kind of utopian society in which we all get to sit back and have super intelligent machines run the world, and they just send us a paycheck or something. I don't know what's going on with these guys. I know about promoting stocks and such, but these guys are ridiculous. Anyway, the interesting news for this week is OpenAI came up with a new application. Not a great name for it, though, Launcher. So the idea of Launcher is that it gives you a web browser, and you give OpenAI a command of what you would like him to do with the browser. He can set up a reservation for you. He can look around for real estate deals, supposedly. So it's a kind of automated or semi-automated at this point web browser called Launcher. The really interesting news that's had everyone abuzz is the Chinese dropped what they call an open source AI called DeepSeek R1. This thing is rather clever. It's not the smartest AI, but they say it's open source, and They say it costs pennies to run as opposed to the more expensive bleeding-edge American artificial intelligences. No one quite knows where it came from. Although, if you ask DeepSeek what it was trained on, curiously, it tells you OpenAI. The one interesting thing about, among other things, the DeepSeek is apparently it utilizes some kind of a self-learning curve. So it kind of asks itself a question, then grades its answer, and adjusts its settings accordingly. So you're going to hear a lot about DeepSeek in the future, my guess is, and that's the big thing in artificial intelligence. Anyone with any questions or comments before we move on to the next portion of this net?
F2CC checking in.
Okay, Brian, you came a little early today. Congratulations.
QYW Jojo at the home base house in New York checking in.
Okay, good to hear you, Joe. Well, I guess there's no one who is interested in talking about artificial intelligence, or if they are, they can bring it up later. We will go to the main section, as always. We do questions, answers, comments, topics. People check in, and we try and keep it to that order. We make little fine adjustments, but I urge people, if they're interested in asking a question and they're short for time, to show up at the beginning of the net and put their name down. Makes it a little bit easier for them to ask their question without much delay. That should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report will join us. That will go to 11 o'clock p.m. Approximately. I will return to tie a bow and everything and wish you well. Assuming that the laws of physics continue to work and the radio works and the shack works and everything works. Anyway, that's the plan. Hopefully we'll be able to do it. So with that in mind, we're open for questions and comments and topics tonight. Hit that push to talk, give me your first name, give me your call sign, and tell me what kind of subject, and if it is a question, if it's amateur-related or non-amateur-related, because we'd like to do the amateur questions first, since this is an amateur radio net.
KF2CC, and 2XN, ham radio-related.
Brian and Wes recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
WA2VDH with a heating system related question, so I'll defer to others.
This is KC2QYW Jojo, put me on the list. Roger, roger, roger.
Okay, John and Joe recognize you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list early tonight? I guess not. But Wes, once again, since you tend to have a lot more questions than the other people, do you mind if I kind of slide you down after Joe? Wes, are you out there?
Yes. Hold on.
Whenever you're ready, this is Brian.
Okay, Brian, one moment. I'm just trying to clear something up with Wes.
Yes, I am here. No problem at all.
Okay, very good, Wes. Okay, Brian, you're up. What's your question for tonight?
Good evening. The question for tonight is concerning the science of sleep. Now, as you know, we spend approximately one-third of our lives sleeping. And I'd like to know the reason for that. If it is I don't think it's really well understood. And in addition to that, how come that people who are active, let's say, get 6-8 hours of sleep, and people who are lying in bed that are bedridden get 6-8 hours of sleep? So why is that a difference?
Okay, AC2GS here. Well, I mean, you could probably get a graduate level course or a PhD on the subject. I mean, sleep is an interesting field. There are things that we know about it. There's a lot that we don't know about it. You're sort of taking for granted that sleep is only for physical rest or exertion. You know, the function of our brain takes up a lot of energy, a lot of time, and it's got to rest too. So, among many other aspects of a sleep cycle is resting your brain, allowing memories to kind of shuffle between short term to intermediate, and intermediate to long term. Every so often, people tell each other stories that they had a problem, they were thinking about the problem, they couldn't figure it out, and they went to sleep, and when they woke up the next day, they sort of had it figured out somehow. Occasionally, you'll hear stories that people had dreams. The discovery of the structure of the chemical benzene has a famous dream-based story. So sleep is a curious thing. There are some animals who don't exactly sleep. They become somewhat more dormant. Animals tend to specialize in either day dwelling or night dwelling because there are different behaviors and characteristics that suit one or the other. You know, if you're a nighttime predator, you're usually kind of dark colored, you kind of fade into the background, and you have good dark vision, whereas you don't need any of that for the middle of the day usually. So there are nocturnal animals and there are diurnal animals, and we happen to sleep at night for the most part, although, you know, some people suggest that our original sleep cycle wasn't exactly what culture and society has forced us into. But nevertheless, different people require a different amount of sleeps also. It's not exactly based on any kind of hard objective evidence. Some people get by very easily on 4 or 5 hours of sleep. Others barely are alert if they get 10 hours of sleep. Thomas Edison supposedly slept very, very little in his life. Everyone has to sleep. If you don't sleep, there are illnesses that cause people to be unable to sleep, and it usually leads to death eventually. But the amount of hours that a person needs to kind of recharge their batteries seem to be somewhat independent of what they did that day. There are a lot of other aspects of sleep, and I'm sure I missed 5 or 6 dozen of them. So if there's any other aspect you want me to talk more about or you want to ask about, feel free, Brian.
Oh, I think that was a very nice synopsis. One question that has always puzzled me, did scientists ever take any readings of any kind of radiation emitted by the brain during sleep? I mean, as crazy as it sounds, whether it's sound, radio frequency, I know you're going to laugh, or other radiation. Just curious, or is it all just chemical?
And to extend with the comment to the first one.
Okay, Wes, what's your comment?
Human ancestors were nocturnal. So we're talking about human species. The early mammals were nocturnal, equipped with night vision that allowed them to survive reptilian predators who hunted by day. And that's from Stanford University. And to extend.
Yeah, but you can evolve from one type to another. You could say the same thing about our ancient ancestors were probably more likely to be vegetarians than the omnivores that we are. So just because your ancestor was one, dealt with the world one way, external ecological pressure kind of forces the issue, you can change that without a lot of difficulty. It just, takes millions of years to optimize. We're still not completely optimized for standing up on 2 feet. That's why backaches are so endemic. But we're well on the way to evolving to be optimally, have 2 feet and walk on those 2 feet. But, it's always subject to change. Evolution can do all kinds of things. Sometimes evolution goes forward, but sometimes evolution seems to go backwards. You had animals that left the ocean and became land animals, and then their descendants, for stresses that required them, returned back into the ocean. You have whales and dolphins and such, who ancestors were land-dwelling animals, just like us.
Yeah, question for you. Do you have an idea at which time, which part of the evolution, human animal, so all of those animals that were human-like, they became more day-oriented than nocturnal.
I don't know offhand. I would assume that it's something that changed way back when there was a common ancestor to both the chimpanzee and the gorilla and us. So that's at least something like 8 million years ago.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wes. Getting back to you, Brian. Yes, there's things called electroencephalograms. I'm sure you've seen them shown on the television or movies. It's, when people have these little electrodes kind of pasted to their scalp, and they're reading electrical potentials, and there's alpha waves and beta waves, and when you go through sleep cycles, you develop rather slow rhythms, delta waves. So there are electroencephalographic changes, which are an indication of the electrochemical potentials and synapses that are firing inside your brain. Each one of those are little currents, and they emit little electromagnetic fields, which get picked up on those sensors.
Oh, I understand that for sure. I just wonder if there's any other type of radiation that's emitted by the brain through the spectrum that just hasn't been picked up or hasn't been tested for yet.
No, that's where the problem. Fiction loves to use telepathy. There's no mechanism inherent in telepathy other than nonverbal communications by gesturing and facial grimaces and other such things. You can give people a nonverbal sense of what you're thinking, but there's no transmitter in your head or a receiver in your head. So those are just lovely little stories that we tell each other.
Did they ever try to remove the sleep center or disturb the sleep center in a living, adult, let's say, and try to determine what the sleep center does?
Well, the problem is that we don't really know if there's a sleep center. It may be a global phenomenon, most likely a global phenomenon. As I mentioned before, there is an ailment that blocks the ability to sleep. I think it has a kind of genetic predisposition towards it, but it doesn't just kind of bloom when you're born. So people in the same family have a much higher risk of it. When they develop it, unfortunately, it leads to mental disturbance and ultimately death. You need sleep in order to process your brain. If you don't have some time to do the housekeeping chores, take your consciousness offline and sweep the dust bunnies out, then eventually it leads to mental destruction.
Okay, I think that's a reasonable answer. So let me take this to another level. Are there things that could be done in your sleep that you cannot do while being conscious? I mean, actually computative tasks.
Not particularly. I mean, I mentioned before that sometimes if you have a knotty problem, when you get up in the morning, you end up with either the solution or a method to find the solution. So your memory kind of jumps around and scatters and reforms, and occasionally that gives you some kind of insight. But generally speaking, it's not very easy to set tasks for yourself while you're asleep. You're sort of on autopilot. We talked a couple of months ago about vivid dreaming, in which occasionally, some people say that they can do it on a dime, they can kind of control their dreams. One of the big problems that I've found is it's not that easy to realize that you're dreaming, no matter how absurd the situation is. If you're flying, I would think offhand that that would be a great indication that obviously you're dreaming, because I don't fly, not by myself. I need a plane. But the problem is that a lot of things get turned off in your brain when you're sleeping. Your motor skills get turned off, otherwise you'd sleepwalk a lot. And another thing is your ability to judge reality seems to get turned off. So if you find yourself flying, more than likely you take it as a given, okay, I can fly. You don't kind of question that. But there are some people, in some occasions, where you see something is going on and it doesn't really make sense with reality, and you have an aha moment and you say, my gosh, I'm dreaming. Let me see if I can control this dream. And I've only, unfortunately, had one such episode in my life. When I was a little kid, I discovered it, and I wasted it by projecting movies on a closet door in my dream. Because I thought it would be interesting to do that. I didn't think of things like flying or kind of being a superhero or anything in my dream. I just wanted to watch some movies on a closet door. We didn't have a projection TV. So, but those are kind of iffy. You can't really kind of sit down and decide, okay, I'm going to solve this answer, this problem in my sleep tonight and wake up with the answer. Occasionally, especially for the sake of autobiographies, you write stories about that, but I think it's much, much, much less likely.
VDH, would a comment?
Sure, John.
On that topic of lucid dreaming, there are some exercises I've seen on the Internet for increasing your capability or your ability to do lucid dreaming, where you dream and you know you're dreaming and you can control it and do interesting things. But so yeah, there are these exercises you can do, right?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there are exercises. I'm sure there are books. I don't know how legitimate they are. I don't know. Unfortunately, people monetize anything. So, if there was a simple way to kind of turn on lucid dreaming, that would be nice. But I am sure the books on the subject and the methodologies are kind of equivocal. Because, you know, a lot of times guys who just know how to do stuff because they just know how to do it, you know, write books not because they can tell you how, but because they can make a buck selling a book. So, yeah, I've heard, and we've talked about that in the past. One of these days I kind of have to look it up and see if there's much to that. Because, again, I've only experienced lucid dreaming once in my recollection, at least. And I kind of blew it on a projector TV.
Yeah, the problem with me is once I realize I'm doing it, that immediately wakes me up.
Well, I mean, a lot of times we realize that we are in a dream Principally because we're at the very end of our REM cycle, and our brain is turning back on the systems that it turns off for most of the night, and all of a sudden your rational centers start to work, and you realize that your surroundings make no sense whatsoever. So sometimes you can kind of strap in and stay there for a while, but sometimes it's just a notification from your brain that it's pulling you out no matter what you want.
Question.
Yes, Brian.
People, is there an increase of a certain chemical or chemicals in the brain prior to sleep and again when waking up?
Brain chemistry is really, really complicated. There are a lot of neurotransmitters, and they're in different places doing different things. So I don't think it's as simple as a neurotransmitter is a kind of general sleep-inducing inhibitor. There's different stages of sleep itself. Initially, you just kind of your eyes close, your heart rate slows down, your pulse slows down with your heart rate, obviously. But later on, you slip into delta waves and random eye movement phase, which is when dreams occur, and there's some belief that that's where the memory management of your brain is triggered and such. So sleep itself is not a one or a zero binary type of situation. It's as simple as a neurotransmitter being discharged over your brain and everything getting inhibited. There's a lot of things going on in there. It's just your conscious mind isn't hooked up to it. But, the rest of your brain is doing a lot of work there.
Comments.
Yes, Wesley.
You know, you're talking about the controlling the dream, coming to another area, which is strictly medical. When I was having courses, we had mandatory, like in most of the universities, mandatory classes. So I happened to have mandatory classes for 5 years, and it was a coach. So there was a professor, Billy Cage, who was a psychiatrist, but he was pretty good in hypnosis, and he explained to us at that time that hypnosis is basically a similar state to when you are zoned out or daydreaming, but where someone else is still guiding your thought process. The both hypnotic suggestions are triggers that are placed in your mind that may still be very effective for the period of time after you are no longer in hypnotic state, but the key to the hypnosis is suggestion. And that could be suggestion or auto-suggestion. Now, the suggestion has two groups. One is a direct suggestion, and the other one is hidden suggestion. And a hidden suggestion is extremely a strong tool in politics, but also in other areas. Okay, so suggestion would be something is pretty, something is ugly, and that would be some form of statement that suggests other people that this is true, or at least think about it. The hidden suggestion has many times stronger impact on the audience or the person you are talking to, and that is like instead of telling the fat guy that he is fat, you say, you're giving him a story. Oh, listen, I was I was working this morning and I saw so many guys jogging. And then I spoke to one and he said, you know what, I lost 20 pounds. I'm so happy. And that makes the person you're talking to think, okay, that would be good if I start, because I have obesity. That form of covert message actually is what makes the hypnosis work. And actually we had the classes, and I was participating in the classes of hypnosis. Back to you, Antoine.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Well, hypnosis isn't sleep. Hypnosis is considered to be a kind of hyper-suggestibility. There are some people who absolutely positively believe it exists. There are others in the sciences who don't think any of it exists. It does not have inherently 100% success. You could hypnotize everyone into stop smoking and, you know, people wouldn't die of as much lung cancer as they do. It can have an effect. It's not, you know, different people respond differently. There are more suggestive people and less suggestive people. But it's not sleep. So it works on a different method that is just, though, is unknown to medical science, unfortunately, as many aspects of sleep has.
Question?
Well, at that time, we were told that 93% of the people are not immune to hypnosis, so 7% of the people in the earth are immune to hypnosis. I saw the effect of it. I did it by myself. Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that, quote, have an effect, but don't necessarily are using the mechanism that was mentioned. And I'm always dubious of anyone throwing out a percentage, because I tend to doubt that they went to India and China and all kinds of places. When people kind of throw out a percent, and if you're able to hunt it down to its source, which is very rare, you tend to find out that it's based on a group of 100 people in Minnesota or something. I always take percentages with more than a few grains of salt.
There was a guy, one of the students who had a problem with languages, and I happened to repeat that what professor was teaching us. Although it was not in the form of teaching, he said never play with that because it may bring you harm because you are not a doctor. And then I told him during the hypnosis trance to recall everything from that particular language. And there is a something like post-hypnosis, but post-hypnosis is valid for half of an hour, sometimes few hours, sometimes few days, depends on the person. And there is a method to deepen it also. But anyhow, that was before the exam, and when he came to the class, the teacher from the language was absolutely in shock. But then I saw that she was trying to test him, and she was like, he was good in it, and he was all the time just playing that he is not. And then I've noticed that during that time, after approximately 35 minutes, he started to faint in that language. So definitely, this is not a joke. It works.
I'm not saying it's a joke, but I'm not saying that anyone knows how it works or to what degree it works. And sometimes it's a disaster. I don't know if you were in the United States for the satanic panics of the 1990, but there was a couple of psychotherapists who were regressing their patients and finding out that they were all being molested, only to find out that this psychotherapist was kind of inserting those memories into them. They didn't actually exist. You can take a pliable person and convince them that they had previous lives, and they will tell you their occupation. Usually they were kings or queens, or they were the assistants of kings and queens. No one worked at a farm in any of these regressions of past life. So again, you know, I mean, the brain is a curious, interesting thing, and there's a lot of strange ways in and out, but this is not exactly a magic key to turn one person into another person. Most hypnotic suggestions have to be somewhat acceptable or presented in an acceptable way to the person. You can't kind of force them to do something that's against their internal worldview rules and such.
I agree with that. A post suggestion, a post hypnotic strength of suggestion actually is based on the ability of the doctor, and the doctor should do it, never the person who is not a doctor, to make the patient to recall given amount of information from the part that is not normally accessible, because we have a long short memory and the long memory, and sometimes the information that we completely forgot could be available with easiness to the person who is in the trance. But anyhow, thank you very much, and back to you.
Okay. I mean, the problem, though, is you might be able to tease something out of their the back of their mind, but it's probably just as easy to get them to confabulate and make stuff up. Alcoholics are kind of infamous for memory loss, and for some odd reason, they tend to err on the side of making stuff up as opposed to telling people, I don't remember what happened. I guess because it makes it seem that they're drinking to excess and they're in denial or such. So confabulation is a common consequence of memories extracted through things like hypnosis. So, you know, let the buyer beware. You don't know. You might be getting a true fact from the past, or you might have this guy just make stuff up to just fill the empty spaces. Anyway, thank you as always, Wesley. Brian, you said you had another question?
KF2ZZ. I just wanted to ask one more question concerning the subject, and that is, I've had on numerous occasions had to have protocol for certain endoscopic procedures as surveillance. And I'm just curious, propofol and other anesthetics, general anesthetics, do they produce the same kind of waves as do people who naturally sleep?
No, it's a completely different thing. It knocks out the consciousness, but it doesn't kind of turn on the other mechanisms during sleep, like random eye movements or dreaming or anything like that. Depending upon how effective, sometimes the dosage is too light and you start to reconnect with consciousness and you pick up little external stimuli. Occasionally, unfortunately, you'll hear stories of guys in the operating room who remember hearing conversations during their operation. So those are, you know, I think probably the surgeon would prefer to think of them as a nightmare or something, but more likely it was because the anesthesia was a little too light for that guy. But no, it's a different thing entirely. You can't get a restful night's sleep with anesthesia, which is something that Michael Jackson discovered after many years.
I knew you were going to mention Michael Jackson. but that was the kind of idea. I wanted to see if the agent propofol was able to induce a real sleep, but obviously it just mimics the lack of consciousness, correct?
Well, it is unconsciousness, but it's a different mechanism. I think the object, the objective among people who abuse drugs and such is that the anesthetic will kind of knock them unconscious, and then after it wears off, hopefully they think they'll just go into regular, you know, REM type sleep after that. So it's just the kind of way to knock you out at the beginning. I don't think they expect it to work if they took enough of a dose to have it run for, you know, 6 to 8 hours nonstop. So I think it's just a kind of a method to induce sleep as opposed to the fake substitute that it ends up being.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the explanation, Roy. It's always appreciated, and I will be listening.
Okay. Very good, Brian. Thank you for participating. John, what's your boiler question?
Yeah, fine business. I have a question about steam radiator vent valves. And I was just wondering, I guess basically, if anybody else has experienced the same thing. I've been replacing a number of my older steam radiator vent valves, and I have found the vast majority of them, I've had to take about four or five of them back. The vast majority of them don't click closed when the steam reaches the vent, reaches the valve. They're supposed to stay open to let the air out, and then as soon as hot live steam hits it, they're supposed to close up and then maybe periodically open once or twice to let the cool steam out. But I have found the majority of them, they just continue to spew forth a hot live steam. I was just wondering if anybody else has noticed the same thing.
Okay, John. Well, I have no expertise in that. My radiators are all hot water. They too have a bleed valve, but they don't have that complication. The idea is you just kind of open it up and let the air escape, and then when water starts to flow out of it, you close it until the next time. Anyone out there has expertise in steam relief valves? Please hit that push to talk.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Okay. Yeah, he's that's a common vent. You know, you, when the moisture gets in there, it should shut. And you know, they do fail. I wonder if he's got the type, you know, the type that screws in. It's like got an eighth inch thread, and on the very top, you have a little cap. You can take that cap off. You know, it'll operate. You know, in case it does leak, you can put the cap back on. I wonder if you have that type of little brass setup.
Yeah, it's the standard eighth of an inch thread. I've gotten both the right angle kind, and I also have some straight kind in case you have a radiator that's in a corner where you can't flip the valve around to screw it in. These have been brand new valves. That's what gets me. I went over to Home Despot and I bought several brand new ones. And they were all, I bought about five of them, and I had to take actually four of them back because they just continued to blow hot live steam, you know, and not click shut after, you know, when the hot steam reaches the valve. I know they're supposed to stay open until the air vents out of the radiator, and then when the hot live steam makes it all the way across the radiator to the vent valve, it's supposed to close so that you don't be spewing steam which can eventually drain your boiler. So I was wondering if anybody else has noticed that.
I know that, you know, they do fail, but you must have got a bad batch, I guess. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a brand. I forgot the brand. Anyway, some buildings, we used to put them in with a little pet valve before it, in case they do leak. You know, you could shut them off, you know, again, a little 8-inch connection. So you come out of the top of the radiator with a little pet valve, but just either, you know, either on or off type of valve. And then you screw the vent in on top of that. And, you know, this way, if it does leak, you can shut it off and, you know, go get another one. But, you know, yeah, sounds like you got a bad bunch of them. So yeah, I really don't know. I'm going back 20, 30 years ago when we used to install them back here.
Yeah, the brand is a Plumber's Choice. That seems to be what Home Despot carries. It's a Plumber's Choice. And it's not that they're leaking. It's just that they don't close when hot steam hits them, you know, gets to them. But, I mean, and it's not only Home Despot. A couple of years ago, I bought a couple at a regular Ace Hardware store, and again, I had to take them back. It was the same thing, and I was just wondering if anybody else has seen the same thing. I mean, I have some of the older valves, and one of the most satisfying sounds I hear on a cold winter night is hear the radiator hiss and then hear it click close. It's a very comforting sound when you hear the radiator valve click close on a cold winter night and after the radiator is nice and toasty. Anyway, I was just wondering. So, anyway, okay, thanks.
Brian with a comment.
Yes, Brian?
Okay, well, I have baseboard, hot water fired, you know, baseboard heat. And what I have on my furnace is a device called the spirometer. I think that's what it's called, or something very close to it. It's a small brass object that acts like a valve to bleed the line of any air. So when the circulating pump turns on, it's very, very just silent, just some little bit of noises of expansion and contraction. Does that help?
Well, in hot water, it's a whole different ball game there. Yeah, I know every hot water system has a place where you can bleed out any air that's in the system. Sometimes every radiator will have a little tap on the top where you can bleed out any air that got into the system. Or sometimes right down by the circulating pump in a hot water system, you can bleed out any air. Because you really don't want any air in there. It makes it very noisy and stuff. The hot water system are nice because they're very easy to zone. I don't think it's you can zone a steam system. I've heard a few cases where they've done that, but hot water you can definitely very easy zone, but just, you know, different circulating pump. But okay, yeah, I appreciate all the comments.
Yeah, it's probably a gravity system. So you can't zone that. It's all designed to have the condensate come all the way back to the boiler. But yeah, the hydronic heating systems are different, you know. I have an automatic vent in the basement near the boiler. And when I bought this house, I installed little T's in every elbow that went down. You know, if you have a supply coming across through an element, and then let's say that element goes down, you know, into the floor, that's where you would put a T for a hydronic system, and then you they're called dime vents. It's just little 1/8-inch connections, and they're mechanically done. You know, and then you could just take a little screwdriver and open it. Leave the air out, but that's where they go. They always go in there, wherever it goes down. But that's totally different from your steam system. Anyway, back to you, Roy. I guess WS to us.
Okay, very good. I was going to make a joke. John asked you if those valves were manufactured in China.
No, I don't know where Home Despot gets its stuff from, but that's why I refer to them as Home Despot.
Yeah, I'm sure they got it at an inexpensive place where quality was probably their third most important thing. But I'm sorry that you're having such a problem with the valves. As I mentioned before, I have hot water, and I recently, unfortunately, had to invest in a new boiler because my old one was 50 years old and it just gave up the ghost. In the past, I recall having the radiators make the banging noise from air being trapped in it, but fortunately, these days, my radiators are almost completely silent, which is probably the best way for hot water-based radiators to make noises.
Yeah, once you get all the air out, hot water is a very quiet, very smooth operating system.
I'm happy with the choice, although, again, been there for 50 years, so I had nothing to do with deciding one or the other. But, once again, sorry no one could come up with a eureka moment for you.
Roy, one more comment?
Sure, Paul.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up, but there was a company called Danfoss, D-A-N-F-O-S-S. They used to have all kinds of steam valves, including the ones that he's looking for. And they had the ones that, you would attach to the to your radiator, and you would have an external bulb, and that would attach to the radiator. And that would control the amount of steam that was inside the radiator. All kinds of different valves Danfoss used to make, but I'd have to get on the computer and look to see if they still make the vents. D-A-N-F-O-S-S. Anyway, back to you.
Okay, very good. I mean, anything's possible. There are some companies that are just so good that they last multiple generations. Unfortunately, there's a lot of other brands that have come and gone, and strangers have bought up the name and, slap it on all kinds of things. Some people are still kind of proud to own RCA-branded items, but for the life of me, I can't tell you where those things are even made anymore. Well, someplace in Asia, most likely. Again, it's one of those venture capital groups that just kind of buy up names and just kind of slap them on brands that are unknown to the American public, and with the idea that with the brand recognition, they could probably kick up the price by 10% and make back their investment.
Hey, Roy, I found it on the Internet.
Oh, good. I hope they're still alive and well.
Yeah, Danfoss. Makes me a little nervous at the price. I can't believe this. $40.40. Wow, where did the time go? Pipe steam air vent, 1/8 inch size by Danfoss, D-A-N-F-O-S-S. And they have a part number, so I guess you can call around and see if anybody has it. These are real commercial. I mean, if you get one of these, it's not going to break. Part number is 013L8011. Anyway, that's my recommendation. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you. I hope John appreciates it. It's kind of expensive for a residential valve. I think John mentioned that he bought five at one time, so that's a bit of an investment.
Yeah, those valves are quite expensive. Even the ones I got from Home Despot, they were like $15-$20. They're not cheap for such a simple device. I mean, I assume it's just some kind of bimetallic element in there that when it gets hot enough, it pushes up against the plunger that shuts it off. But I don't know. I've seen some of them that are up there in the $40-$45 range, I know. But yeah, I will check this place. I appreciate that, Danforth. I have it written down here. I will check it on the net because I have a hunch I'm going to have to replace some of the other ones soon. But so I appreciate all the comments. So once again, thanks.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for your participation tonight. And I hope that you no longer have any steam radiator problems. That hopefully this particular manufacturer has better quality assurance issues than Home Depot does. Joe, KC2QYW, are you still around? We'll try one more time. Joe, are you out there? You checked in earlier, and I'm just checking to see if you're still there. Okay, I think Joe got distracted or had to leave, or we'll try again later on. Wesley, you got some questions, or actually you got some topics tonight, so give it to us.
Yeah, I'm radio related. Okay, so starting from the first one, I give you the leads from 7 points. Some of them are just for 2 minutes, some of them are longer, and I would rather try to give a pause of the comments to you, as you have a tendency to a very precise and concise and short explanation instead of me not being so much fluent in English. Okay, so the first topic is general talk about directional antennas, Yagi antenna, and electrical connection to the boom. And there is a number of questions, and those questions are numbered, so, and that was January 20th, 2025 at 9:40 a.m. That was 6 days ago. So if, instead of me just reading the questions, if you can go through the questions and answer them. And to explain.
Yeah, I don't have that email up on my screen right now. It probably would be the most efficient if you just ask the questions, and I'll try my best.
Beautiful. So question number one, because it's a general talk about the antennas, and actually it's general talk about directional antennas. So if you say a few words, what is the Yagi, then the question would be, and how that differs from a vertical dipole, let's say, then the first question would be, is the electrical connection to the boom of directors and reflectors required in directional antennas, and what about the Yagi antennas? Back to you.
Okay, well, the short answer is no, it's not required. Some Yagi designs couple the parasitic reflector and director with the conductive boom, and some don't. What was the other half of that question?
So, is electrical connection to the boom required by reflectors and directors in, let's say, Yagi? So let's take Yagi. Back to you.
Yeah, well, that part I answered. It's not necessary. It can either be insulated or it can be connected. Both models will operate. They'll require some tuning of resonances and distances of the reflector and the director, but both will electronically function if they're connected to the boom electrically or insulated from the boom completely. Also, I think you mentioned the first time about the difference between a vertical and a Yagi. A Yagi is basically a dipole. It is a center-fed half-wave dipole the novel new thing of the Yagi-Uda antenna is that it uses at least two parasitic elements. Those are elements that are not connected to the driver, the transmitter, but act parasitic.